This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if a woman can survive, they may find.
What will the climate be like in the year 2500? Provocative new science shows Midwest wheat fields transform to tropical palms and grassland scrub where the mighty Amazon rainforest once stood. It's too hot for any human to go outside in India. Lead author Chris Lyon takes us deeper into the future. Then the great escape, getting off the planet before existential risk ends the human experiment. Calamity Theory with author Joshua Schuster. Get in the time machine. Talk about inheritance. What kind of world are we leaving our grandchildren? Does it matter if great-grandchildren inherit a hellish climate? Until now, the great engines of climate science have not tackled the longer future. Reports, treaties, and projections end at the year 2100. No matter what we do, the world will keep on heating up after that, possibly beyond the limits of endurance for humans and crops. Certainly the sea will keep rising over shorelines and ports. A study published in 2021 takes us into the climate of 2200 right up to the year 2500. After running the models for different scenarios, they engaged artists to show landscapes on the new hotter Earth. The Midwest wheat regions become tropical by then. Drone machines harvest crops in the no-human-outside lands of India. The paper is titled Climate Change Research and Action Must Look Beyond 2100. We reached the lead author, Dr. Christopher Lyon. He is from McGill University in Quebec and a visiting research fellow at the University of Leeds, UK. From Montreal, Christopher Lyon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Chris, how did climate models and institutions get stuck at the year 2100 like nothing matters after that?
The year 2100 emerged when the first climate models were produced in beginning in the 1980s. And at that point, 2100 was still quite a distance away. And I think that when we did start looking that far into the future, the people who were making those models assumed that we would have been further ahead on, say, climate mitigation than we are right now. But we are. And time has passed. And throughout the IPCC assessment reports, which began in 1990, and the other science that fed into the and built on those initial climate models, 2100 became basically institutionalized as our long-term date. And then a couple people over recently have pointed out that maybe we should rethink this, but nobody had taken substantial modeling work to look beyond that date to have a look at climate change. I mean, that being said, there has been some more simple models that have projected the 2300 or 2200 or dates like that, but they aren't featured as the main long-term benchmark for climate change.
So what brought you and your team of 13 scientists to study climate change after 2100?
We've been fixated on this date, and we'd be forgiven because of that fixation and all the work that we talk about and publish and research, that sea level rise or warming estimates and things like that would stop at 2100, but they don't. So because that date was set almost arbitrarily 30 or 40 years ago, it's worth rethinking that and taking a look beyond to see how our estimates for what the climate might do in 2100 match up to what happens beyond that date.
And I take it you are familiar with Kim Stanley Robinson's nonfiction sci-fi book, The Ministry for the Future?
Yes.
So in Robinson's book, 20 million people in one part of India die in a monster heat event. As part of your project, your team at University of Leeds modeled and then made an artistic portrayal of India in the year 2500. People survive outside only in air-conditioned spacesuits. Can we narrow down how soon a mass heat death could be possible in India, for example?
I think we're at the edge of the time where we can start to see that happening. We have seen some significant heat stress events in places like Europe and elsewhere that have resulted in really disproportionate levels of mortality among more vulnerable populations. But when we start to edge into the high heat stress or the high, let's say, wet bulb temperature heat in Robinson's book, we start to see, you know, the potential to impact, let's say, your typical average, relatively fit and healthy human. Because our human there's physiological limits to how much of certain kinds of heat human beings can tolerate. I mean, if you put yourself in an oven at that kind of a temperature, obviously you can't deal with that. But when you have a very humid heat, for example, if you're in a sauna, you quickly realize that you can overheat. Your sweat doesn't evaporate the same way. You can't cool yourself fast enough. And if you stay in, you can get in a lot of trouble very quickly as your body sweats and dehydrates and is no longer able to manage its internal temperature. In Kim's book, Robinson's book, I think his scenario takes place later in the 2020s, which is not that far away. And I believe there are some scientists who think that is plausible.
Why did you use the older RCP, the Representative Concentration Pathway System, used by the UN, instead of the newer SSP, the Shared Socioeconomic Pathways, when people want to calculate science and climate policy?
SSPs build on the RCPs. So SSPs are like RCPs that also incorporate socioeconomic scenarios that are coupled with different emissions trajectories. And the RCPs themselves build on earlier methods of looking at how emissions and the atmosphere interact to produce different climate scenarios. RCP actually stands for Representative Concentration Pathway. I'm not a climate modeler, but what this basically means is a measure of how the atmosphere measures different heat forcings from different inputs, such as solar radiation, atmospheric gases, aerosols, and that kind of thing. It's not that we didn't use SSPs, we used RCPs, which are part of SSPs, for that reason. And the other reason is that they were easy to use within the constraints of our modeling efforts in our project. And what we'd encourage researchers to do is to start to incorporate more sophisticated modeling efforts using the latest set of SSPs that appear in IPCC, the AR6 report, and other sources. Because one of the other tenets of our paper was that it was an initial step in this direction, and we wanted to get our case made and our argument out in as clear a way as possible and use that as a stepping stone for other scientists to develop more sophisticated modeling efforts.
Right. This should be happening broadly. Now, could you give us a broad rundown of the three scenarios you considered and how it looks, maybe starting with the year 2200?
So what we did is we looked at RCP 2.6, 4.5, and 6. 2.6 roughly agrees with the Paris Agreement, which means that we reduce emissions in the near term to a level where we start to stabilize the global temperature and avoid the worst effects of warming. RCP 4.5 and 6 are varying levels of more severe warming with lower mitigation efforts. And so we plotted those out to the year 2500 using our model. And we also tied in heat stress and vegetation to that as well. And so what we start to see up until the year 2200 is a significant change. So we see a significant, let's say, depletion in Amazon rainforest forest cover and its replacement with, let's say, grassland or more barren landscapes. We see in other parts of the world as well, we also see a pretty steep change in vegetation cover. We see increases in temperatures. The first figure in the paper, if your listeners are look it up, you can definitely see the slope of temperature is steeper up until the year 2200, and then it starts to decline. So the progression of temperature increases, slows down, but it still increases. Even for RCP 2.6, which is the Paris Agreement, we're still increasing till about 2100, and then it's slower, gradual decline in global average temperature until 2500. If you look at sea level rise as well, it still continues well beyond 2200 in those things. So to sum that up, before 2200, we're looking at significant changes in our model in global biomes, in temperature, in sea level rise, in heat stress, and these all have impacts on how, where and how we live. Now, granted, I'll caveat that and say that ours is just one model. Other models may or may not fully agree with ours. We did in ours, in our work, plot five model estimates out to about 2300, and they fall within the range of ours. So we would expect that other modeling would also suggest something similar.
As you say, of the three scenarios, only the lowest, RCP 2.6, offers much hope of containing heat to the limits of mammals and our food, and that's our best-case scenario. Is it realistic? What has to be achieved to get there?
There's a couple of points I want to make on that. One is, these are global averages we've worked out. You can see on some of our global maps the different variations in temperature at different times of the year. So one of the things we'd like to explore is what parts of the world would still fall within, let's say, what we would expect to call a habitable range of climate variables and vegetation variables, whereas other parts might not. So first thing we need a better understanding of how that plays out regionally across the planet. So within RCP 2.6, we still see things like a much more rapidly warming Arctic and what that implies where people can live. We still risk fires, floods, heat events, storms under RCP 2.6 going forward. So it looks like an easy ride, but it really isn't. Whatever we're facing right now with the climate is still going to bring a change from what most of us have grown up with. And that's challenging. To hit RCP 2.6, we need to rapidly zero emissions as fast as we can. And I say zero and not net zero, because if we start using net zero, there are ways we can play with the math on that that don't actually mean that reduces emissions in the way we need to. So we need to actually move as close to a zero carbon world as we possibly can, as fast as we can, if we want to stay within that trajectory.
With our current increasing emissions, and the United States went up, for example, in their greenhouse gas emissions in 2021, and we have a lack of carbon controls, experts suggest we're really on the road of the UN's worst-case scenario, which was RCP 8.5. Why didn't you include that in this study?
There's a couple of comments to make on RCP 8.5. We did try to model that within our study, but it produced values and instabilities in the model that led us to question whether it was working or not at that level out to 2500. That is a very hot world, and we would need to investigate further whether that's plausible in terms of what our model was capable of. We use one of a whole basket of climate models that are out there, and others may be better at estimating that higher heat world out 500 years than ours was. The second point I want to make there is RCP 8.5 is controversial even among climate scientists. So there's a number of papers, good exchange in the journal PNAS, and a good Twitter exchange between several climate modelers about whether RCP 8.5 is a realistic projection. And those revolve around the idea that it is unlikely that we'll, despite what we see right now, it is unlikely that we will continue to maintain a high fossil fuel world into the future. And we can see signs, despite increases in emissions, we also see the rise of renewables, divestment campaigns from fossil fuels, and other measures to move towards reducing our emissions. So I would hold my breath on whether RCP 8.5 is realistic until some of the efforts that are underway right now start to appear in the data at scale.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from McGill University is Dr. Christopher Lyon. We're talking about climate change in coming centuries created by human greenhouse emissions now. Human societies can adapt to growing heat up to a point. But what about the crops that keep billions of us alive? Chris, talk to us about agricultural challenges after 2100. What have other studies found about this?
There's not a lot that look at agriculture after the end of the century. What most studies we see now focus on is migration of crops and the potential for them. There are some indications that climate is changing growing regions for certain crops, and projecting those into the future is something that we did, and we start to identify quite broad ranges of estimates of where crops might end up or what crops might be more optimal in the world of a high heat climate. It is really hard to say with high confidence on what agriculture will look like going into the future. It depends on how we manage land and agricultural economies. It depends on what kind of crop technologies and breeding we use. We've been changing crops as we've domesticated them since the beginning of agriculture, and we continue to do that now. And so going into the future, are we going to produce, and we touched on this a little bit in the paper and some of our illustrations, heat-tolerant crops that are viable in higher heat environments or lower water environments, or there's people working on now on saline-tolerant crops that you can grow in coastal regions. So crop technology plays a significant role in what we might see beyond 2100. What I might suggest is that we need to start thinking about that now, especially if we start to miss our RCP 2.6 aims. We need to start thinking about how we're going to feed whatever populations we might have on Earth at that range. And that technology is only part of it. Distribution of food and the just distribution of food is also part of that. And that's also a current issue, too, is we have significant poverty and food insecurity throughout the world. So it's a very complex question, but it is something that hopefully our paper stresses is important and we should start thinking about.
Did your study suggest that some land will be lost to staple crops as Earth heats up over the next centuries?
Yes, it did. We see changes in locations of where crops can be grown. We do project some decline in the optimal regions for some crops. Some crops do better. What we didn't do closely is look at things like soil chemistry, land type, and all the other variables that grow into producing crops. We didn't make estimates of, let's say, vertical agriculture, for example, or any sort of alternative cropping technologies and how these would play out. Those are all scenarios that we can explore, and some of them would be very contingent because we end up dealing with things that haven't been invented yet, for example, in the case of some of the crops that we suggest could appear in the future, or some of the technologies we might use to grow and harvest them in places where humans can't readily live outside.
As I look at figure 3 in this paper, the central tropical belt of Earth fills more and more with that angry red color representing temperatures too hot for humans to survive without support by machines like air conditioning. In the worst case, RCP 6.0, it looks to me like up to a billion people will either experience mass death, mass migration, or both. So what do your findings really mean about a possible troubled future for humanity?
I think they paint a pretty scary picture, especially if we don't mitigate climate change. And I'm going to caveat that very carefully here by saying if we continue to try to maintain the sort of political systems, institutions, nationalities, for example, that we live now, failing to mitigate climate change means that some of those things become the question. We're already seeing the loss of low-lying states and coastal regions due to sea level rise, and some of those are essentially a foregone conclusion now. We talk about them in terms of loss and damage and terminology like that. But as climate change intensifies at scale, it starts to affect more and more people across larger and larger regions. We don't put in place political institutions and mechanisms for helping the people that are most affected by climate change, so then we end up in, I think, some pretty dark places. So there's a trade-off, I think. Mitigating climate change now means a certain degree of continuity in the kinds of places and cultures and politics and identities that we value now and that give our lives meaning. If we fail to mitigate climate change and we start moving towards a hotter planet, some of those things come into question, especially if the more habitable regions face a large influx or pressure of more people to move there. In my personally, I think if we fail to mitigate climate change, and even now, the aim should be to keep as many people as we can alive and well moving into this future. And that may mean that we have to give up some of the things that we hold very valuable right now and that we're quite used to. Because really, when we're talking about this sort of future, we're not talking about us. We're talking about how our children and grandchildren and their grandchildren will be able to live on this Earth, because it's the only planet that we have.
We have a lot of listeners in the United States. What did you find for the future of the U.S. Midwest breadbasket?
In our projections, we especially the ones that deal with lower mitigation of climate change and higher emissions, we found that the Midwest gets a bit warmer and a bit more humid. So the Midwest you're used to say that today, which may have a more temperate climate, certain kinds of agriculture, certain ways of life might look different in 100 years or 200 years or 300 years.
And what's the projection for that great mother biodiversity, the Amazon rainforest, a few centuries from now?
Unfortunately, if we fail to mitigate climate change and if the deforestation that's currently ongoing there halts, we still see a significant change. It moves from a lush, biodiverse rainforest to a hot, barren, dry landscape.
Cynics argue that humans only care about their own lives. I think if we ask, most people will say they do care about the future of humanity, and most of us mean it, even if we don't change our own climate-wrecking ways in every way we could. Maybe we don't model a future after 2100 because who cares? We'll all be dead by then. What do you think?
I don't really buy into that way of thinking. If we have children, we care about our children. And if we have grandparents, we certainly see how they care about us. So caring about the future is something that many of us invest heavily in. That cynical view that I'll be dead anyway is in my view, quite selfish and seems to speak to this highly individual way of living, I suppose, that we're so accustomed to now. And you see it manifesting in things, I think, now like the anti-vax movement and climate denialism and why should I change my life? I don't, this sort of thing, right? You can't tell me what to do sort of logic. And that's an artifact of culture. I mean, I think as long as humans have been around, there's been selfish people. But we also live in a paradigm, we can call it neoliberalism or whatever else, that values the individual over the collective. And we're being faced with reality that is forcing us to think and act more collectively and think about our futures in a more substantial way.
So people wanting to understand heat and human survival need to learn a new acronym, I think. It's UTCI, Universal Thermal Climate Index. What is that, and why do we need it?
UTCI, or Universal Thermal Climate Index, is one of a basket of measures for understanding heat stress. And so UTCI specifically looks at human heat transfer, which is the way that the body regulates and manages heat relative to atmospheric conditions. There are other measures as well. There's different versions of how to measure wet bulb temperatures. There's a humidex, which a lot of people are familiar with. There's a few different heat index measures. There's something else called apparent temperature. And so there are a basket of different ways of looking at how heat stress happens and how it affects humans and other animals and plants and infrastructure. So what measure we use would depend on its fit for what we're looking at. But I think the idea of heat stress more generally is something that people should become familiar with, because we can see how it is affecting us during heat waves we see now, as well as the sorts of things that we talk about in the paper.
Christopher Lyon, you came through a background of science for resiliency, including your report for the Government of Scotland. But if parts of the planet do become uninhabitable, does resiliency start to mean an ability to survive migration and resettle?
You're actually touching on a debate in the resilient scientific community about what resilience means. So you can have a form of resilience that suggests that you can adapt in place to these kinds of changes. But you're perfectly right in saying there are changes that we can't adapt to, and that actually does mean we start to look at things, adaptations or transformations, such as relocating to different places, changing the way we live in the places that we are right now. So resilience is a big term, and there's a lot of ideas that you can pack into it. And some of those include leaving where you are and being able to rebuild your life somewhere else. And I think that's a realistic possibility. This is happening now. Communities are talking about managed retreat. There are questions about the viability, for example, of places in areas that are going to be hit by storms and fires. and we're seeing that happening right now. It is extremely disruptive for people to leave the places that they know, that they grow up in, that they love, that they identify as their home. But again, we are looking at changes that are in place and will continue to manifest even if we meet the Paris Agreement aims for quite a long time. So for me, I think getting used to the idea that we're in a longer period of flux and being able to get our heads around the idea that some of us are going to have to leave places that we're used to, that our families may have been there for generations, our communities and our children have grown up in, is a realistic possibility. And at the same time, other people would be wise, if especially to live in a place that is safer or more stable or more habitable, to open up their communities to newcomers and to people who need the kind of refuge that their places can offer.
I asked you about Robinson's book, The Ministry of the Future. After suggesting there is little chance of going back to our former climate, your team proposes new kinds of institutions. Tell us about that.
That comment was definitely building on Robinson, but other people who have called for different kinds of institutions to govern the world that we're facing in what many people call the Anthropocene. We talk about in big terms like adaptive governance, anticipatory institutions, things like this. The way to frame this, perhaps, is to look at the institutions we use to govern ourselves were built before and through the fossil fuel era, and they're also built on some pretty strong philosophical assumptions about individualism, about identity, about nationalisms, about how economies should be run. We fought wars over those at different times, and we still fight them. But the world at that point was in some ways bigger. We were less aware of our impact on the environment. There were fewer of us making that impact. We didn't have to feed as many people. We didn't have the same high consumption footprint lifestyles that we have right now. But the world has now changed, but we're still trying to govern it with some institutions that grew out of a different kind of a world. So if we're going to govern ourselves through centuries of environmental change, the comment in the paper was asking what kind of institutions do we need to build or do we need to have to allow us to do that justly, even through some of the harder moments. So if we can do that, then I think we have a fighting chance. And if we don't, then, and we still operate through our current institution, I worry that puts us on a pathway to conflict and maladaptation.
We are running out of time. I wanted to quickly ask you what you think about the people who think we will go extinct probably long before 2500. I don't agree. Humans made it through the Great Ice Ages. What do you think?
I would agree with you, I think. I appreciate the fear and the worry and the sentiment of extinction, because we are facing unprecedented times, and it suggests people are recognizing the scale of what's happening. But I also, I suppose, side with you in the sense that we are very adaptable. Every generation that's coming up now is growing up with climate change. They're creative. They're less bound to those old ways of thinking and old institutions that maybe you and I were. So I have a lot of hope that we might see some very surprising innovations, if you will, in how we coexist with each other in the coming decades.
Your team emphasizes your September paper on climate after 2100 is just a beginning. What are the next steps?
I think the next steps is to take some of the cues that we've highlighted in this paper and develop those. What I'm particularly interested in is developing communication tools that reach people. One of the things we don't do well in science is communicate our research, and we often try to target policymakers who have other priorities or other interests over climate change, where if we try to communicate our work to the general public, to key organizations and other institutions who are able to make change, I think we may see some more effort and some more action on climate that is effective. For example, the film Don't Look Up has made its way around the world. I think it's one of the top film ever on Netflix. It reached a lot of people. And it was about climate change, but used the analog as a comet hitting the Earth. And if we can communicate science through story, through narrative, through art, through games, through the things that people actually stop and read and look at, that's one of the next steps that I would like to take.
From Canada, we've been speaking with Dr. Christopher Lyon, working with both McGill University in Montreal and the University of Leeds in the UK. Find links to his paper, Climate Change Research and Action Must Look Beyond 2100, and all the science we discussed in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Christopher, thank you for this work and sharing your time with us.
Thanks very much, Alex. It's my pleasure to be here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Professor Stephen Hawking and other scientists believe that to secure the future of the human species, we must colonize another planet.
To stay risks annihilation. It could be an asteroid hitting the Earth. It could be a new virus, climate change, nuclear war, artificial intelligence gone rogue. We can, and must, use our curiosity and intelligence to look to the stars. We must do it now before humanity is overtaken by some disaster that we can neither anticipate nor control.
Call it long-termism or effective altruism, but get ready for a ride. Big names like physicist Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk boost the cause. It sounds good at the start. We owe a duty to future humans and all intelligent life from animals to the octopus. In an apparently barren galaxy, we must at all costs prevent extinction of intelligent life on Earth. To do that, says Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom, humans will merge with artificial intelligence, becoming transhuman. That new life form must spread beyond this planet to populate other worlds. Bostrom catalogs the most dire threats from nuclear war through climate change to genetic tampering. Others get on board like the Australian philosopher Toby Ord and astronomer Royal Sir Martin Rees. Millions of dollars flow in from tech moguls like Bill and Melinda Gates and Peter Thiel. New institutions are founded, such as Oxford's Center for the Study of Existential Risk and the Future of Life Institute at the University of Cambridge. That is where we start, at the bottom of a foggy future where post-humans inhabit a technical utopia in the stars. Is it real? Is it helpful or harmful to us right now? Toby Ord, author of the influential book The Precipice, told me he is too busy with other projects to appear on Radio EcoShock. Nick Bostrom's assistant says he is on leave until end of January. Bostrom is author of Superintelligence, Paths, Dangers, Strategies. Our audience is probably too small for him anyway. So we depend on two critics with views on ecology, justice, and what it means to be human, where we are, as we are. Canadian academics Joshua Schuster and Derek Woods just published their book Calamity Theory, Three Critiques of Existential Risk. Dr. Schuster is author of The Ecology of Modernism, American Environments and Avant-Garde Poetics. He is currently on sabbatical in France. From Paris, Joshua Schuster, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
How did this existential risk movement begin?
Well, mostly it's attributed to a specific philosopher named Nick Bostrom, who's a philosopher at Oxford University. It's about two decades old, and it's a movement really just to think, what are the possible end scenarios for humanity and for the planet?
And this school of deep future thinkers may be influencing corporate and political leaders, maybe even military planners. Why are big threats like climate change or genocide demoted, made less important in their view?
I should go back a little bit and say, yes, when existential risk theory really started taking off, it became very popular among a lot of well-known technocratic elites, especially Elon Musk. Bill Gates is interested in it. Jan Tellin, the founder of Skype, and many others. And that already asks the reason, why is it so popular with that kind of audience? But as you said, also, it's popular with like defense planning. I've seen the United Nations people using this kind of language. And one obvious reason is it's very technologically friendly and very sort of, let's say, top-down friendly, where the decisions might get made by a set of elites who are capable of manipulating technology or political systems very effectively. It is not a bottom-up movement. It's not a grassroots movement, intellectual or sort of social justice movement or environmental justice movement. And that's one of the main critiques we have of it. So it really views sort of disastrous scenarios that people are generally familiar with, things like nuclear warfare, runaway climate change, artificial intelligence going haywire, things like bad actors using nanotechnology or biowarfare or stuff like that. So these are all very, very important issues, no doubt. And philosophers should have something to say about that. But the methods matter, the ways we talk about these matter. And we need to include everyone. And so it should be a democratic thing. It shouldn't be a technological solution or a top-down solution.
And I think we're going to have to lay one of the groundwork parts of this, because one of the founders of this, Nick Bostrom, who's a Swedish philosopher now at Oxford, was first known for promoting how he would like to become a transhuman. What does it mean to be transhuman, and why, in Nick Bostrom's view, are we obligated to go there?
Sure. Yeah. So these are actually closely connected in Bostrom's mind, the idea that we should study existential risk and the idea that we should tend towards transhumanism. And transhumanism means just the enhancement of the physical body or the mind towards better and better and longer lasting and more capable capacities and using technology to do that. The idea, one of the main reasons they're linked is because if we are able to enhance ourselves, maybe we can control some of these existential risks and we either be smarter about them or more morally, let's say, embedded or technologically capable of stopping some of these problems. So the idea would be existential risks should favor these kinds of what might be called super technologies, and they will help us in the long run. And that's why it's an obligation, because otherwise we're going to be stuck with these existential risks because they won't go away.
To put it on a ground level, are we talking about maybe importing Wikipedia into our brains so we don't have to look at our phone all the time? I mean, it would be exciting to have eyes that could focus like telescopes at will, that kind of sci-fi stuff. Josh, would you accept body modifications, and will we need them to compete with those who do?
Well, I'm not anti-technological, and I certainly think technology will help us. I mean, we won't make it through this energy transition, which is not just in terms of fossil fuels, but it's a whole cultural transition, a sort of planetary transition. We need the technology, there's no doubt. But we need a lot more than that. We need forms of collaboration and better democracies and more art and more education and so on. There's a lot of ways we can go forward. I mean, I don't mind, you know, being able to download a lot of information, but the funny thing is you can just Google it anyways, right? You don't need the whole Wikipedia in your brain to be a better human. One of the complaints we have with someone like Nick Bostrom and existential risk movements is that so many of the utopian things, the science fiction scenarios that you just suggested, so many of those are already available to us. We have basically all information, you know, at our fingertips, and we have time to write books if we want or to do other things like save the planet. Right? There's nothing stopping us. So, in fact, we don't need the massive technological upgrades that they think that we do.
In your book, Calamity Theory, you and Derek Woods take issue with the narrow definition of existential in existential risk, and it's at the foundation of Bostrom's proposal. What's the problem there?
So we were quite surprised that actually no one really involved in the existential risk movement, and there are other philosophers, by the way, most notably Sir Martin Rees, who's a scientist as well. So just the handful of philosophers out there who are interested in this field in particular don't really examine the term existential at all. They are not existential thinkers, and they're not interested at all in that field. We are, however, we're not sort of card-carrying existentialist members, but we're interested in the philosophy and what we can learn from it. And I do think it has a lot to tell us today. And we argue that it really just starts from being an embodied, precarious being among others. So not just humans, but animals, of course, and plants. And that embodiment matters. So we're not just talking about like abstract math or logic here. To have a body in a specific time and place is a key starting point for what knowledge and philosophy is. And that's the basis of existential thought. Furthermore, existential thought is engaged in thinking about big sort of things that confront existence, like mortality, or sometimes called finitude in existential philosophy. And it says that the life and death of the thinker matter. That makes a difference in philosophy. And it's something that needs to have a thought, a method, an engagement, an interpretation. And all that together will be will be guidelines for living, living together, and sharing each other's sort of existential space.
I remember reading back in 1989, the British comedian Ben Elton published his book Stark. And while Earth Goes to a Hell, sounding pretty much like today, the ultra-wealthy and their bankers and people plot to get away in a spaceship looking for a new home. And that was ironic science fiction. But tell us about the grand vision Nick Bostrom deploys as the real goal and duty of humanity.
So, you know, the scenario you described does sound like the playbook for someone like Elon Musk, who is definitely a big fan and leader of Nick Bostrom. Bostrom himself, I'm not sure if that's something that he's in favor of, but Bostrom certainly wants super intelligence and artificial intelligence to be escalated. And he hopes that that is something that is accomplished in the near future. Towards the end, that would be that people would have much longer lives. Perhaps, as Ray Kurzweil says, you would live long enough to live forever. In other words, mortality itself wouldn't be a problem anymore because our physical or mental capacities are so enhanced that there's no more fatality. So these are all, you know, fantasies maybe or utopian horizons. And I think the job of someone like myself, I'm not convinced that that's actually as utopian as it sounds, but also that we should come up with better utopias too and make those convincing as well.
Well, we're looking at a lot of faces that have joined this movement, but to be blunt, the whole crowd looks to me like white capitalist men. Many of them are located at the former helm of colonialist power in Britain. Josh, do you suppose that influences their view of priorities for humanity?
I definitely think the existential risk field itself should be more diverse, and it certainly methodologically, it doesn't have to be just white men. There's different kinds of, let's say, think tanks, we could call them, out there. There's one called the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at Cambridge University, and they certainly have a diverse number of people working there. So it's possible to bring it in the right directions, but it's still a question of the philosophy itself, the method, and the main ideas. They themselves need to be more, to me, things like a white capitalist idea is to make decisions for other people, right? Rather than consent and consultation and participation and democracy. It's to sort of, you know, build something and say, you're going to have to, it's now compulsory, you have no choice. I think there's ways that the methods and the science and the technology itself can be more shared and shareable, more participatory. And to me, that's the better utopian horizon. But I don't see them building that in their ideas. And I don't see them building it in the technology. You know, Elon Musk is not building in a participatory form of car or solar panel. You know, he gains the profits and that's the model.
But Nick Bostrom, he does call us to value future life and not just humans, but all intelligent life. So I think some environmentalists can agree with that. So not just to act as though, well, as once we're gone, nothing matters. He's saying, well, once we're gone, a lot matters. And we have a duty to the future and to future people and their happiness.
Yeah. So there's a kind of related movement called long-termism that's become popular as well as another somewhat related movement called effective altruism. And someone like Peter Singer, a well-known ethical philosopher, is involved in that. And all of these arguments sort of borrow from each other. And they do think that, yeah, it's important to have what they would call utilitarian values of happiness that are spread to as many people as possible, as well as to future generations. So on the face of it, that sounds very utopian, that we would have all this happiness and much more happiness in the future if technology can grant it to us, you know, in a fair way. But on the other hand, I'm not so sure, you know, when they say that, you know, happiness is something you can calculate and sort of quantify, and future generations, they might be in the billions and so on. Suddenly you get in this model in which you're already, again, buying into this technological salvationism. When I think, again, technology can help us, but we can already share the planet. We can already enjoy each other's company. We already can be a lot happier than we are. We can already do a lot more in terms of sharing and enjoying and playing together and making art. And none of that, again, requires, in my opinion, utilitarian philosophy or technology or enhancements or anything like that. And finally, you know, all this is about future generations too. And I think one of the major duties we have is to bequeath a future that isn't in debt to us. Financially, you know, climate-wise, they shouldn't be in debt to the choices that we made. But I also want to say existentially, if we made choices in terms of who we are existentially, like now, you know, we've all upgraded ourselves, future generations won't have that choice. they will be required to follow our decisions. To me, that's thinking about future generations means letting them have those existential choices too.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with our guest, author and assistant professor Joshua Schuster. We're talking about radical long-termism and his new book with Derek Woods, Calamity Theory, Three Critiques of Existential Risk. So yes, your book offers three critiques of existential risk, and these are deep, they're well explained, but they're not really easy to boil down, but let's give it a bit of a shot. Could you outline your first major criticism of the existential risk movement?
Okay, so we do take issue with some of the basic definitional terms that Nick Bostrom and others are using for existential risk. Bostrom himself famously says an existential risk has to be total, means that there has to be full extinction. So other catastrophes, things like world wars or pandemics or genocide even, these won't count as existential risks because they weren't total. And we already think that that's ridiculous. Why does that version of the definition need to be the standard for existential risk? So we question his first definition right from the outset. The other major critique we have in that first chapter is that Bostrom himself actually, although he's a philosopher and he's very smart about how to use philosophy, he doesn't actually do much, let's say, philosophizing. He's very good at making lists and coming up with summaries and scenarios and very quick, brief definitions and typologies, we call it. But he doesn't actually have many conversations with other philosophers or do much citation or do much, let's say, more dialogical work in philosophy. And we think that's a big problem in his ideas and in the field generally.
Your second critique investigates the use of mathematics and probability theory employed by Bostrom and others to link with solid science. With these theories of existential risk, are we dealing with science really or belief?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that's something that my colleague Derek Woods would be much better answering than I. And I'm thankful for Derek and how we collaborated together on this book. But I think the question is definitely, you know, about how much, let's say, probability or science is really going on in these estimations for existential risks. These philosophers would like to view themselves as scientifically correct and accurate or defending a form of scientific approach to these problems, these catastrophic problems. And in that sense, they sort of distance themselves from the humanities. And they hopefully have the ear of, you know, technologists and mathematicians and other sort of policymakers by using the language of science. But so science, we think, should include things like science fiction, other humanities tools, speculation, creative speculation, utopian building, different forms of conversations and collaborations across the fields of the arts and sciences. So science doesn't boil down to this kind of rational calculation or a statistical view of what form of disaster might happen here or there. It should be much more broad-based.
And I'm still learning about all this. I'm reading Toby Ord's book, The Precipice, but so far it looks to me that apparently humanity as we know it cannot be saved. We are completely obligated to transform ourselves into a new species, and then we can enter a utopia that lasts a billion years on a billion planets. It sounds so much like a New Age religion or even an old messianic text of heaven and hell. Do you and Derek get a religious feel from this group and these ideas?
Yeah, absolutely. Many of them do have that kind of, you could call it secular messianism, because it's not a belief that a God will save someone, but that sort of technology will. And yeah, but this kind of thinking draws from this longer history of salvationism. And it's not something that Derek and I think is the right way forward by any means. We're much more interested in, you know, the fields of the humanities and science working together, you know, step by step through things like consent and consultation and dialogue and sharing both the benefits and the burdens of living on the planet together. You know, we don't need these almost impossible utopias to make some progress. And I don't think those are the most reasonable utopias to imagine. I think we can do better in our utopian thinking. I also think we can do better in our dystopian thinking, because to me, constantly thinking about the most dystopian scenarios, that in itself is pretty dystopian.
Well, okay. So how powerful do you think the existential risk crowd has become in real world decision making?
I think they are quite popular and they're growing. They are very popular in Silicon Valley, and that field is has a massive amount of power, we could say, and attention these days. Just it's important to do this philosophy. It's important to have these critiques. I think the field should welcome these critiques. They shouldn't think that they don't need some form of critique and wider engagement. You know, there should be a way forward. There's many great ideas. Bostrom is quite smart about some of his approach to the field, and it's helpful to have someone like that to question and challenge. But the field shouldn't be just the reserve of the technological elite. I personally think, the only right philosophy is one that includes everyone on the planet and engages them and has their well-being and their flourishing in mind. And to me, that's what existential philosophy is, and that's why it's different than existential risk.
The system proposed by Bostrom and Ord, and it's supported by the late Stephen Hawking and other English-speaking luminaries, as you mentioned, to me it sounds a little bit like Plato's Republic. The low-class producers and auxiliaries will always be disposable as long as the guardians survive. What do you think?
Yeah, I hope it's not that kind of the 1% that get to live in the ideal city or that run the city in Plato's view. Yeah, and the only ideal city for me is one where everyone's running it together. That's the true definition of democracy. So we have to make social forms and technological forms that can do that. I don't know. We don't maybe have the technologies yet, or we don't even have the language yet, or the stories, or the philosophies that will let us do that together. And again, it's not just humans sharing the planet. It's all forms of life doing this together. But that's a real project. That just means that everyone, there's a lot to think and a lot to do. And I'm excited for that. And I'm, hopeful in that sense. To me, the scenarios where it's just a small sliver of people who succeed and the rest, are just disappearing somehow. And some, already that's extremely dystopian. And how people disappear, that won't go well. So there's no place for Plato. That city doesn't go well at all.
Well, we may enter a time when any alienated person can make a killer gene in their basement. We may have to have cameras in every basement. So would it be okay to accept global fascism if that's what it takes to survive? And would that still fit in with this picture of existential risk?
Yeah, that's a key question. I've seen people talk a lot about that kind of scenario thinking where surveillance or control somehow becomes the only thing that can prevent someone from doing some terrible act, especially as technology gets more advanced. I can't imagine any technology that would actually work that well, that wouldn't create its own other additional problems. I don't see that total surveillance as an option whatsoever. I think any philosophy that ends up saying that's the only option is not a great philosophy and we can do better. To me, it misses the fundamental thing, which is people should be encouraged to enjoy each other's presence or share the planet. It sounds, maybe a little naive or way too optimistic, but to me, I think people are more likely to do terrible things when they don't feel included or they don't feel heard or they don't feel like their life is part of a pathway towards flourishing. So that just means we should do better work on the existential side of things, not necessarily the technological side. But when people feel welcome and included and shared, it's just a better world and it's a safer world. So maybe reducing existential risk, the best way forward is to develop those kinds of collective practices.
And that doesn't fit on Bostrom's list of the most extreme things.
No, and that solution doesn't fit on his either, because again, they think technology is the only likely scenario we have going forward, some form of technological security.
Well, maybe you and Derek are just old school thinkers stuck in the past, like those green groups who want to save the old natural world. Do you oppose technology?
No, again, I don't. I would already say, everyday life is very technological. We don't need to dismiss the importance of technology, and it'll help us share things and work together and collaborate and learn about each other. So technology is helpful. We just don't need what we could say is like a cult of technology where we think it's going to solve all of our problems and that it has all the answers. And in fact, it'll do philosophy for us. Somehow if we can program the machines, the machines will do philosophy for us and we'll be done with philosophy. But I think that to me is the worst scenario, because I don't think philosophy is ever done or finished, and that it's all about a participatory kind of endless practice of thinking and thinking together. So we can use technology in a more playful way going forward than this sort of kind of aggressive, kind of both utopian, dystopian way that we're headed for at this point.
Do you think environmentalists should be attracted or nervous about long-termism? Is it an ally or a threat? What are your views?
I think so much depends on, you know, what that phrase will mean and how it gets defined. And I think this is the opportunity for everyone to sort of talk about it and make criticisms and revisions. But of course, we should think long-term. You know, deep time is another phrase. But it's not long-termism just for humans or for intelligent humans. It's for everybody. Evolution itself is a form of long-term thinking. And long-term thinking also connects to, you know, how can we share the most we can with it, with, you know, the most people out there. And maybe things like universal basic income is the right way forward. I would just add, you know, things like universal basic play or universal basic, you know, food and water. And, but I would even say, you know, transportation, bicycles, universal basic bicycles, universal basic community participation. These kinds of things are as important as the technological fantasies that are, that seem to occupy so many people.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to talk about with our listeners?
Well, I hope I've given a convincing criticism of the existential risk movement and our book adds to the conversation in a helpful way. I still remain pretty optimistic. One of the kind of quick summaries I have of this book is that, so I think we need a lot of change in terms of what I would call ecological content, things like solar panels and electric cars and renewable fuel technologies and so on. So that would be ecological content. But we need a lot of ecological form too. And things like sharing and participating together and consulting and using philosophy and using art and finding ways of sharing the planet together. So that's what I call ecological form. So I think the book says that we need, you know, ecological form or existential form as much as we need these things like content going forward. And I hope that, you know, that's a way forward for a lot of people to start to be included in these conversations.
We've been speaking with Dr. Joshua Schuster. He's an associate professor at Western University in London, Canada. Schuster and Derek Woods from the University of British Columbia just published their book, Calamity Theory, Three Critiques of Existential Risk. You can find links to follow up on this discussion in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Josh, thank you for spending some good time with us.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceships flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.